And the first thing we need to do is to build a dictionary. And to gain intuition on this dictionary, we need to do checks in both sides that tells us what are the relevant degrees of freedom in one side related to the relevant degrees of freedom on the other side, and so on and so forth. So we need to perform some checks. So I was telling you that because we are dealing with strong interactions, the only way we know of performing checks is to use symmetries. So dictionaries are built based on very highly symmetric theories, and yesterday we were talking about n equals 1 super QCD in a particular limit in a conformal window. And I explained how Cyber realized that in this particular area of the parameter space of supersymmetric Jan-Mills theories, he was able to find two theories, and that was the electric and the magnetic duality between two different theories. All right. So the duality in this case was pretty simple. It just meant that you had two different theories. One is weakly coupled, whereas the other is strongly coupled. And what you know is that they will describe the same Faraday physics. But what the Cyber wasn't able to do is to build a one-to-one correspondence between operators in the electric and in the magnetic field. So this is not exactly what we want. But it's at least an example of a strong, weak duality. A much more interesting example is the ADS-CFT. So what I'm going to do is to explain to you a few basics on the ADS-CFT, and then we are going to discuss this paper that I mentioned. So what is the ADS-CFT? First thing, this is a conjecture done by Maldacena, where he conjectured that there are two theories. One is tends to be a string theory in a particular space, say DS5, until the sitter in 5 dimensions cross S5, where this is the sphere in 5 dimensions. And he proposed that this theory is actually dual to a completely different theory, n equals 4, so 4 super symmetries, super Jan-Mills theory. This is just a conjecture, but the reason he proposed this conjecture is that there are checks you can do in both sides and check and see if the results are equivalent in n equals 4 super Jan-Mills in type 2B string theory. Actually, this checking this conjecture is in a particular limit. What he did is to take the string theory in this particular space and take the supergravity limit, whereas in the other side, he took the limit of the superconformal field theory, a strong coupling. In particular, what he was assuming is that the curvature of ADS times the length of the string to some power, the string scale, it was equal to 1 over 4 Jan-Mills, the coupling of the Jan-Mills theory times the number of colors of the Jan-Mills theory. So Jan-Mills theory is just an abelian theory. And what he said is that I can check this in both sides if at least in one of the sides I'm in the weak coupling limit, so weak gravity, whereas in the other side it's strong, but still it's conformal, so I can say things. So the limit of Maldacena was precisely k ls. The curvature scale over the string scale is much smaller than 1, which means that the two parameter, the Yamil's square and c, is much bigger than 1. So you are taking the correspondence in the weak gravity limit versus something that is larger, number of columns, and strong coupling. That was the conjecture. So we had these two theories. Those theories are pretty complicated, but at least I can start testing if these two theories are dual in particular limits. So most of the tests or the ABS-CFT are done in those limits, supergravity on one side and a super Yamil's conformal free theory on the other side. Yes? In, you can parameterize ABS, phi, as being the metric will be 1 over kz squared, dx4 squared minus dz squared. So k is the curvature scale. And it will be also the typical scale ultraviolet cutoff we are going to have. All right. So this duality is a weak versus strong coupling duality. This is what we want. Oh, this is what we are looking after, what we care about. This is what we can do. And there was other entries for this dictionary. For example, on the gravity side, we know that the isometries of ABS, so the ABS 5 spacetime, actually correspond to the conformal group. Of a 4D superconformal field theory with n equals 4. So at least at the level of symmetries, there seems to be a one-to-one matching. And it is a kind of trivial matching because the isometries of ABS are precisely the conformal group of n equals 4 super Yamils. And even more interesting, the supersymmetric theory on this side has a particular set of R symmetries, is S of 4, SU4 R symmetries, and they correspond to the S of 6 isometries of S5. So in the ABS-CFT correspondence, we see that the isometries of spacetime, both of ABS and of S5, correspond to some symmetries in the conformal field theory side. In one case, it's the conformal group itself, and in the other case, it's just the R symmetry behind the n equals 4 supersymmetric theories. So, of course, because there are so many symmetries, even in the weak strong limit, essentially, you can say many things, but this correspondence is of a useless versus a useless theory. Because the world is not n equals 4 superconformal, so even if we believe that there is strong electrobic symmetry breaking, it's not precisely it's generating masses, mass scale, so it's not going to be superconformal. And we had to recover n equals 0 standard model at low energies. So all these ideas of the ABS-CFT are very, very nice. But at the same time, you know that whenever you are able to prove something in both sides, you are also very far from realistic theories, for at least for the standard model. So that's a pity. So in any case, the rationale here is, okay, so we are going to develop a little bit the ABS-CFT, think on what are the main lessons, and then try to see if these lessons stay when we really get rid of a lot of symmetries, and we really don't care so much about the isometries of ABS. So we are going to try to extend and massage the ABS CFT to build a realistic theory. So let's do that. First, we need to understand a little bit about the ABS CFT. So we have some entries in our dictionary. Another entry in our dictionary is actually that the position in the extra dimension in ABS corresponds to the energy scale in the 4D picture. Why is that? It's because if you look at the metric, there is a rescaling invariance. You can always do any coordinate in the 4D world. You can rescale it by a factor. And as long as you do the same with Z, with the extra dimension, the whole physics should stay the same. So the scaling invariance comes from the isometries of ABS and is ensuring that I can always interpret going to smaller and smaller distances in the 4D picture, so bigger and bigger energies, as moving towards smaller and smaller Z. Yes.
What's the range for Z?
Yes, so for the moment, in pure IDS5, the complete IDS5, Z goes from 0 to all the way to infinity.
So there's a boundary at Z equals 0.
Yes, thank you. That boundary is going to become important. So there is a boundary for the space time. It's at Z equals 0. And in principle, this coordinate is infinite. Yeah.
Does the metric also is one of those special for proton transformations?
So this is just a subset of all the isometries of ABS. But I want to illustrate this point, this intuition that as I move into the extra dimensions, I'm describing the physics of the conformance theory or the 4D theory with a lower and lower energy. So moving over here is like lowering energy. So you can think on this boundary as being my ultraviolet physics. And if the extra dimension extends to infinity, I'm going all the way to the deep infrared physics. So this is the first useful entry of the ABS CFT. Whenever you have an ABS space, there will be this scaling invariance. And this has a very nice interpretation from the 5D to the 4D point of view. What else can we say? Well, remember that in the ABS CFT, a conformal field theory has no asymptotic space, no asymptotic states. There is no scale, and there is no S matrix. Which is what we need to describe our real world, where things scatter with each other, and that's what we care about. So, no asymptotic space, no S matrix. It's very difficult to imagine how we are going to do real phenomenology with this conformal theory. So in the ABS CFT, the correspondence is not between states in one side and states in one side, but the correspondence is that the bulk fields in ABS, which say is a field that depends on four coordinates and the extra coordinate, are going to correspond to the only thing I can describe in a conformal theory, operators of my conformal field theory. Let's call these operators O. Okay, so that sounds nice, but we need to specify how we do this correspondence between fields in the ABS space, in the gravity side, and operators in SVF design. So what Malacena said is, okay, so these ball fields acts as, will talk to operators, but the way they will talk is by setting that the boundary value of this field, so this at the boundary, this is a four-dimensional field, right? So this guy is going to correspond to sources of the CFT operators. So we are going to do an example of this precisely, don't worry, we are going to see what it means. But the correspondence is set by saying, okay, so ball fields are representations of the operators on the conformal field theory side, and the way we represent them, or we link them, is by setting that the boundary fields, the four-dimensional excitations of this boundary, of this ADS field on the boundary, is precisely acting as a source of the CFT operators. And Maldacena's proposal was to say, well, the correspondence acts in the following way. I say that the string partition function that depends on fields which whose boundary condition is precisely what I'm saying here. This is going to be, by definition, this thing here. All right. This is just saying what I say in words, is saying that the string dynamics at the boundary are precisely acting as a source for operators in the CFT. So let me write down what this means exactly. This is equal to some integral over all the CFT states, some action on the CFT. And then on top of that, I add this boundary term. That's what it means to have an average over the CFT. Whereas in the other side, what this means is an integral now over all configurations of the gravity fields and the action on the bulk of 5, where I said that the boundary conditions are phi naught is equals phi of x, z equals 0. So I'm taking the usual bulk action, but I'm making sure that when I evaluate this bulk action, the boundary values of these fields are precisely phi naught, and those are the same phi naught that are acting here. So at this level, I know that it looks a little bit ambiguous, or you don't necessarily know how to act on this. So let's do an example of a scalar field in ADS, and then it will be much clearer. So, okay, summarizing, the way we build the ADS-CFT correspondence between operators in the CFT and fields in the ADS is to make sure that these fields, the boundary values of these fields, act as sources for my operator in the CFT. So if, for example, I want to obtain any endpoint function of these operators, what I have to do is to take derivatives of my effective action. So now, it depends, if not, over the fields. Okay, so let's do an example and that will be much clearer. If you want, at this stage, you're just taking a recipe. The recipe of the ADS-CFT is whenever you want to build your correlators of your CFT, or your strong coupling regime. You just have to take your effective supergravity action, make sure that the fields, when they are evaluated on the boundary, they take the same form as being the source for this operator. So let's do that. So, example of a scalar field in ADS. So we want to think on this scalar field as a source for some operators in the CFT side. For the moment, we are going to assume that the space is precisely ADS5, where Z goes from 0 to infinity. So when you look at the equation of motion of a massive scalar field in ADS, this we've done many times already, here is the operator that contains the metric. And what we are going to do is use an ansatz. We are going to assume that this guy, that depends on four dimensions and the extra dimension, is going to be some easy plane wave in 4D and some function that depends on ZP. This is going to be our wave function. So we are going to plug these ansatz into the equation and see what we get. What we get is the following, that the equation for this guy, let's call this U. So U is ZP, is a dimensionless quantity. And the equation for this wave function is precisely U phi du. Minus m squared k squared. This is my equation of motion. So I need to find solutions for that, and you know what they are already. So this function of u is going to be u squared, and then a linear combination of Bessel functions of this order. And I'm going to define where delta is just 2, 1 plus square root 1 plus m squared over 4k squared. Okay. So delta is a particular combination that has to do with the bulk mass of the field. So those are the solutions. But now, because we care about, for the moment, we care about the infinite version of ADS, we don't want things that diverge at infinity. So to make sure that the function is regular as u goes to infinity, I need to get rid of one. Yes? K.
M squared over k squared?
So that's m squared over 4 k squared.
That case, the curvature radius.
Yes. So let me write here. Where is it? Let it. No, don't worry. It's good. This is the curvature radius. Okay. Yes.
The k and I functions in the solution, are they Bessel or something else?
Yes, they are the Bessel, the modified Bessel functions or special Bessel functions k and I that have to do with the imaginary parts of the j and y that you are used to. Is that because if I use this set of functions, then it's very simple to see where is the good behavior u going to infinity, because the y, this is the y of delta minus 2 as u goes to infinity, is divergent. So we need to impose that b is equal to 0. Is b? Yes. So to have regular solutions at infinity, we need to get rid of this part. And we just have a wave function that looks like as a k function, Bessel k function. Okay. So now we build our solutions in the bulk, right? Those are the bulk equations of motion. Now to set A, we need to bring some boundary conditions. So to determine A, I need a boundary condition. And guess what my boundary condition should be? What is the boundary? But the boundary is z equals 0, right? This guy goes to infinity. And I want to use the ADS correspondence that is telling me something about the value of this field precisely at the boundary. So my boundary condition is going to be that phi of x and z should go, as z goes to 0, should go to phi naught, to my source. And I'm going to call this source, this is going to be IBX. So that's my boundary condition. So you remember our field was F times exponential of IBX, where F is this solution on the bulk equations of motion, and we want this to be phi naught, which is exponential of IBX, just the plain wave. What it means is that F at z equals 0 should go to 1, but this is not possible. The reason this is not possible is that the k diverges as the u goes to 0. So what you do is to regularize the position of the UV boundary. If I just do this, I get no solutions. But what I can do is to move a little bit the UV boundary. This is in z equals epsilon, a very small value. And then I'm going to follow my procedure, the procedure that Maldacena said, and then I'm going to send epsilon to 0 and see if everything is correct. Instead of f of z equals 0, 1, we say of epsilon. And that means that, yes. That phi of x and epsilon is equals epsilon p squared plus u squared, remember? Then we have the a, and then we have the k delta minus 2. Of epsilon p, and this guy should be x. So is this just telling you that a, this guy is equal to 1, and that gives you the value for a. So you see a, the constant we want to obtain, is divergent with the position of the UV boundary. So that looks like 1 over p epsilon squared k delta minus 2 of p epsilon. Alright, so now we're solving the equations of motion for a scalar, massive scalar in ADS with the boundary condition that this scalar, when it touches the boundary, is precisely the source for our operator. So we can write what is our solution. This is going to be what is called KPFX, the bulk to boundary propagator. So we are obtaining a solution for the field in the extra dimension, but making sure that it's always the boundary condition is precisely phi naught. So this is this solution that you build with this particular boundary condition, that phi at the boundary is phi naught. This is called the bulk to boundary propagator. So that's z, and it goes to epsilon. This is equals to, what we just say here, z over epsilon squared k delta minus 2. an exponential px. Okay, so that's my bound to boundary propagator. As you see, I just plugged A and I had a U square in the front, so I just got rid of the piece. That's what I think. So how do we build our solution? Now we are ready to move into obtaining, for example, endpoint functions of operators. So what I need to do is to take the action in the bulk with this particular field and then take derivatives respect to phi naught, which is this guy here. Well, so let's talk about two-point functions. That's the simplest thing we can talk about. And then we have our action at the quadratic level in fields. So my action in phi d is just a scalar with a kinetic term and a mass term. That's the way I obtain the bulk equations of motion. So now we want to plug in here our bulk to boundary propagator that depends on the source, phi naught. And then I want to take functional derivatives respect to phi naught. Because I know, for example, if I want to obtain the two-point function of my operators of P and Q, and this is just going to be the second derivative of my action, where the boundary field is given by this guy here. Respect to lambda 1, these parameters that I'm using, these dummy variables, that at the end of the day I'm going to set to 0.
Can you explain why the action we have before? Sure. Basically, what the effective action is, why we're allowed to use effective action here?
So.
Before you wrote down the gravitational path integral.
Right.
But we don't want to be doing a
pattern
for over.
Yes. So in the right, you're right. Okay. So in this guy that I wrote before, what you're doing is summing over all going over all the configurations whose boundary condition is precisely finite. So you can write down this as an exponential of an action, in this case of supergravity, at least for the IDSCP, that just depends on phi naught. And this is precisely what we are going to do. What is this procedure of going from here to here? It's what we are doing. We are obtaining the equations of motion, solving for them, making sure that they have this precise behavior, that the value at the boundary is phi naught. And then what I'm going to do is to substitute this particular solution over here, which is what it means here. Sum over all configurations, all solutions, but making sure that the boundary condition is correct. Once you do that, it is very simple to obtain what is the two-point function. You know that it's just taking second derivatives of your action that now depends on phi naught by varying, for example, one of them and the other one. In the bulk.
Yeah, but like in our action we have no gravitational term. You just wrote the action.
Yes, so this is the metric, but you also will have d for x of your usual d. You'll reach it and so. But okay, so this this is something we are going to discuss a little bit later. If you just have gravity, how do you interpret that in terms of the CFT? But here I want to do a thing that's a little bit different. So imagine I have a scalar in the bulk. What is the interpretation of this scalar, the mass of this scalar, from the CFT point of view? And what we are going to see is that the mass of the scalar is precisely setting the dimension of the operator. So in this sense, it has nothing to do with the gravity part.
My question is that the scalar field will couple to gravity, so it will change the metric.
Mm-hmm. So we are assuming that there is no back reaction to the metric from the scalar. Let's think on a dilaton, which is an assumption. That's very good. So that's the procedure Maldacena told us to do, so we are going to do that. We are going to take this action, but evaluate the action in this particular set of solutions, and then do this derivative. So, what you are going to obtain as the action is going to be let me just particularize for radius. This is going to be 1 over k z to the fifth, as you obtained yesterday. And then you get k z squared because of the, here there is a g mu nu mn, the partial of m, partial of n, that's what it means. So we are going to get the operator in 4D minus the second derivative operator in 5D. That's for the kinetic term, but you also get some m squared. And this guy. Sorry, I didn't do this very well. This is going to be dx5 squared, dz5 squared, and then the mass term of phi squared. And what we want to do is to substitute the value of 5, like this is any solution on the equations of motion, but now with this boundary condition. So we want to say phi of x z is precisely this bulk to boundary propagator. We also want to say that phi naught is going to be a linear combination of plane waves. So this action, when you substitute, is pretty complicated, but the only thing you care about is things that do not vanish when I send lambda 1 and lambda 2 to 0. So let's see. So we take this part here. This guy, when you derive respect to x here, you are going to get things like lambda I exponential of pi x. And this is going to be a square. So when you derive twice and then put lambda 1 and lambda 2 to 0, this guy is giving you no contribution to the two-point function. So the terms we have to focus on are this one, the z derivative, and the mass term. So this term, dz phi square, is equal to phi not square, and this f of the wave function square. So if you take, and now you are going to, so you get this kind of terms, and then you are going to take the second derivative respect to lambda 1 and lambda 2. So it will be the derivative of phi naught respect to lambda 1 and respect to lambda 2. Because there is the only place where I have a dependence on lambda 1 and lambda 2. So you do that, you're going to get something like it. So we are almost there. The only thing we had, we already took this functional derivative, and we send it to zero. The only thing we had to do is to take this action and take the integral over z and do this integration, so that we end up with just a four-dimensional action. So you remember the wave function was pretty complicated. It contained this k, Bessel k. But at the end of the day, what we want to look for is things that are... So we want to do p for q. And we know that this guy is going to already be equal to the... This guy integrated over d4x is going to give us delta of p plus q. And then you have to start expanding k of delta minus 2 of u for very small u. Right? Because you want to evaluate distance on the boundary. And you know that the most important contribution is going to come from the boundary. This is a little bit long, but I'll just give you the result. At the end of the day, the most important piece that is not, that doesn't vanish as I send u to zero, is precisely a piece that goes like this. This still looks as a divergent depending on the value of delta, of course, but as a piece that may or may not diverge as we go to epsilon equals zero, but actually this is just due to the normalization of phi. So you remember a scalar in phi dimensions has different dimensions than a scalar in four dimensions. You remember one is 1, the other is 3/2. So to match the dimensions, we need a parameter, and this happens to be this guy here. So the pieces I want you to focus on are precisely this dependence with p. So if I want to understand what is the behavior of the two-point function in position space, then this is going to be taking the Fourier transform of this guy. And if you do that, you are going to obtain something like this, x to 2 delta. So the behavior, well, essentially because this guy goes as p to 2 delta minus 2, and this guy goes as pq. So when you integrate that, you get precisely x to delta in that dimension. You can just check the dimensions, and those are the dimensions. So I guess from your conformal field theory class, you understand that that means this is the operator square, right? So the dimension of the operator is going to be half of this. It's going to be delta. That's what it means. What it means is that I'm getting the two-point function of operators of dimension delta, and by conformal symmetry, you can see that this two-point function should look like that. That 1 over x to 2 delta. And I hope you've seen that. Huh? Okay, good. So you remember, this is my interpretation in the CFT side, but actually this is, at the beginning I said this is 1 plus square root 1 plus m squared over 4k squared. So a dimension of an operator in the CFT corresponds to a scalar filling the bulk of mass m. So we built another entry for the dictionary. If I want to switch on operators in the CFT of dimension d, one simple way is just to add in the bulk a scalar, a dilaton, of mass m. And then I have a one-to-one correspondence between the two of them. So that's That's nice. So actually this Maldacena recipe seems to give a nice entry for the ABS-CFT. All right. So you see, up to rescalings, at the end of the day, we can work on the ADS5, the full ADS5 from the boundary to infinity, and obtain a sensible CFT theory and a dictionary. But because we don't care, we want to break conformal invariants, we need to do something. Do you have an idea what we need to do to break conformal invariants in the ADS picture? Yes, but the black hole acts as an infrared regulator, something that is set in a scale T. And so you can do that, you can do Z equals 0, and then extend and cut the geometry up to the black hole horizon. Because I want a realistic theory.
Where?
Ah, at the TV scale, ultimately. But that.
Do you want performance symmetry at high scale still? So that's near the boundary.
Yes.
So you want it to remain synthetically adhered?
Yes. So I want something that near the boundary is not messing around with my Maldacena recipe. I need to keep my interpretation of the boundary because this is the only way I can make a connection between the ADS and the CFT side. So this I don't want to touch. But I want to break conformal invariants. So one way is adding a regulator. And in random sundum, instead of asking for a particular black hole, you just add by hand an infrared brain. So you add a second boundary, either assuming that it's some kind of brain you just put by hand, or assuming that the geometry itself ends at the horizon of a black hole. The two are exactly the same type of physics. So it's adding a regulator, infrared regulator. So we are going to redo the scalar field, but now it's an infrared regulator. So the way this infrared regulator acts is because now when I want to solve my equations of motion in the ball, then I have to take into account the presence of this brain. So I have to assign some kind of boundary conditions near this brain. So the equation was u squared, something proportional to the Bessel I, plus something proportional to the Bessel k, where this is still delta minus 2. Okay? And then exponential 5px, the final. This was my solution. And before I said, okay, so because I want solutions that are regular, as I send this brain to infinity, I must get rid of this part. But now I want to keep it. Because now I have a compact space, and in principle, my solution is going to be a linear combination of the Bessel K and Bessel I. So, assume any boundary conditions on the infrared. You can assume whatever you want. Let's say I assume, for simplicity, minus boundary conditions. Remember, minus means the function at the boundary is equal to 0. That means that this guy times the I function evaluated at the boundary plus this other guy and the k function evaluated at the boundary must vanish. All right. And I know my boundary conditions on the UV. My boundary condition is that my phi of x and epsilon is precisely phi naught. That tells me that this guy here has to be 1, as before. So I have epsilon square p. Same thing, but now substituted at the ultraviolet. So let's see how the presence of this infrared brain is going to change our picture. So let's solve for, we have two equations, and we have two unknowns, A and B. So from the first equation you get that A is minus B, K at the infrared, Y at the infrared, and if you substitute in the second, you will get essentially that B is equals A. Okay. At the UV, at the infrared, minus K at the infrared, I at the UV, and some 1 over epsilon squared. And the A is the same with a minus sign, and instead of a Y, you get a K of the infrared. Same thing. So let me, okay, this is epsilon question. Let me call this guy the denominator. Let's call it D. Why I want to do that is because now when I take my action and I substitute this field in it, and I follow the same procedure as Maldacena said, so now my wave function that depends on u is going to be 1 over d epsilon squared. This is just because of dimension, we know that. So it's going to be k of the ir, my I function plus I of the ir, my k function. Alright. So now when I do the same correlator, what I'm going to obtain is the same result as before. I will have a part, something that looks like p squared 2 delta minus 2. But whenever this guy goes to 0, I'm going to have a pole in my function. So in this correlator, besides this, I'm going to also have an expansion of some functions, and some poles. And these poles are precisely the zeros of D. So you take a function, you are going to evaluate the integral of this field, F squared. But you know this field gets to infinite from time to time when these guys get to zero. So the way to represent that is that you have some poles or some propagator, and this is just, you want, these are the residues of this pole. So you see, adding an infrared brain is an important step, because now instead of just having our usual CFT, we added on the picture, just by adding this infrared regulator, an infinite set of KK modes, magically. And this is making conformal invariance like math. It's setting particular positions in momentum space, the ones that make this denominator to vanish, to be important. Those will be the poles of the Michaelis-Klein propagators. So the presence of the infrared brain is very important, because it really breaks conformal invariance, and that's why we need a regulator. Yes. But we are not scared of that. We know that in a propagator, so you take the propagator in phi d of your Kaluza-Klein decomposition, you are going to have an infinite set of zeros, your Kaluza-Klein decomposition. Nothing to worry about. So, okay, so the Maldacena recipe, you can use it to obtain a relation between the dimension of your operator in the CFD and the mass, so the dimension is going to be precisely delta, which is 2, 1 plus some relation of the mass. But also, if you add an infrared regulator, no matter what kind of infrared regulator you add, you are going to end up with these zeros, taking conformal invariance in a very nice way. Okay, so any questions?
What if you have a spherical black hole in the 88 space?
Yes.
So not a constant Z?
Yeah, okay, so you would then use this kind of, you would not use this Poincaré patch. You would use something different. If you want to look at the, so there is a solution of the equations of motion in the presence of a black hole in ADS. It's called ADS Shorty. And it has been studied, first it was Witten. He has a very nice paper about that, and then everybody worked on that.
We studied it in Reed's
book.
We know all about the thermodynamics of it. We studied it in Reed's book.
Ah, that's cool. Okay. So it's ADS is Shorty. And of course, you wouldn't be using this guy here. And that's something more convenient. Okay. Any questions?
So you end up with the expression of two-point function. Why is the dimension of the operator still delta? Doesn't it get any correction?
So yes, it gets this correction, but this you cannot interpret as a CFT correlator. If you Fourier transform that, this is not going to look like 1 over x to some dimension. It's just an expansion. You know that it's breaking conformal invariance because it's setting special points in momentum space.
So this sort of takes care of the anomalous dimension?
Another thing, you cannot interpret this as an anomalous dimension. It's as if to your two-point function, you added a bunch of sources. Sources located precisely at this pole. So it's not changing the anomalous dimension here. You will read the anomalous dimension from here. But yeah, that's a good question. This is non-analytical. Okay. So you are bored, you can work out these results. I mean, you just have to look at the solution I already gave you, put it in the action, and see, and expand for a small u, because you care about the small u. Okay. So now we are ready to discuss the paper of holography and phenomenology. Have you looked at it a little bit? What is your understanding, thoughts, complaints, questions about it? What do you think, Maeve? Or what did you understand when you read it? Like, when you imagine you want to explain this paper to somebody else, some person is not following this course, what would you say this paper is trying to say? Like, what is the leitmotif?
Trying to look at CFD and gravity and figure out, here's an example of the
Oh, yes, so it's about the CFD. But what is important about this paper, it's not especially well written, it's not typo free or error free. But what is nice is that it was the first paper that had that dare to go beyond the ADS CFD. Before that, either you understood, you had a bunch of supersymmetries and a very good understanding of what's going on, or you couldn't say anything. This paper said, working in RS, which is a simple version, a truncated version of ADS, we seem to find things in the bulk that we could interpret as four-dimensional strong coupling. So this paper was the first one where they sat down and really dared to write down something about it and not get all the string theories killing them. So that was a really their paper in that sense. So they are trying to expand and massage the ADS CFT beyond the real validity of the ADS CFT. They are really trying to get inspired on the ADSC to gain understanding on duals of strongly coupled theories which are not conformal and don't have a bunch of supersymmetries. So that was the take of the paper.
No
supersymmetries. conformal invariants.
So to put it in context, it's only 2 or 3 years after the Balasena's original paper, which was quite, what's the word? It was quite amazing. So I guess that people spent that all that time trying to check it and prove it. I
mean,
it's hard to prove because you have to properly prove it, you have to understand the strong coupling limit of either string theory or gauge theory. But it's difficult to prove, but people checked it, and it still seems to be right.
Yeah.
It just got more right.
But also, what this paper is saying is not, there is no proof of what they are saying, right? They are kind of getting an understanding from one side to the other, but it's really not a like proof of anything. The same as the Maldacena conjecture is a conjecture.
But the change of perspective is now that, okay, well, it really looks like it is true, so if it is true, what can we deduce? What can we learn about strongly coupled theories, assuming this duality?
But if you were a purist, you would say, well, once you give up all these checks, like we really go to the regime where you don't want a conformal field theory, you are breaking it, and you don't want a real idiot putting boundaries everywhere, many people would say that you have no clue.
You have no right to believe that it still works.
Yes, exactly. We know that the ABS-CFT checks of the ABS-CFT holds for very particular cases, but what this paper is saying is, imagine it holds for anything. So some ABS spaces with stuff inside will be dual to some four-dimensional strongly coupled theories. So we are trying to get a feeling of what kind of four-dimensional strongly coupled theories we are dealing with. Okay. So you read the introduction and a little bit of the different sections. Any questions?
What does ADD refer to?
Kalihamed Valley Dimopoulos, the large extra dimension. Because you have one of the authors there. More questions? So did you add some? The first thing they do is to say, okay, so we know, assume that our duality is actually between duality in ADS with strong coupled CFEs in 4D of any kind. And then they try to make a connection between the two. And the first way they make a connection is adding an ultraviolet ray. So did you have a look at that? They say, okay, so I have a CFT, no asymptotic space states, no S matrix, nothing I can say. But at least if I go from Z equals 0 to Z equals epsilon, in our exercise it looked like you had to do that just for convenience, just to set epsilon to 0 at the end of the day. But their interpretation is that moving from Z equals 0 to Z epsilon means that you are going from the energy or the cutoff in 4D going to infinity to a finite cutoff. So one interpretation is that your cutoff is precisely M Planck. So you can track your CFT up to M Planck. So the interpretation is moving the UV boundary is actually adding a cutoff to your CFT. Or in other words, when you add a cutoff in your CFT, it means that your CFT is able to feel gravity. And you know that this is a very nice explanation because the way you feel gravity is 1 over M Planck. Suppressed interactions, so when you send this to 0, you don't feel gravity anymore. So actually, setting the boundary to 0 is decoupling gravity. That's the interpretation. Yes? Do you need to explain anything? Okay. And so, assume that this is what the way you interpret the Planck ray. Let's do a check of that. So what they say is, let's do this check in the following way. We are going to compute something in the gravity side and in the CFT side that accounts for this moving the ultraviolet ray. So in the gravity side, they say, okay, so I know that gravity in ABS means that there will be some modifications of the Newton potential. So when I leave, instead of four dimensions, in five curve dimensions I will get. So this is M1, M2, and Planck. In four dimensions, 1 over R, this is your Newtonian potential. And the presence of this ADS space is giving me a correction that looks like KR2 squared. So this is something you can do in ADS to compute where is the correction of to your Newtonian potential. So keep in mind that this picture already has set going to infinity. This picture where we have ADS, we move a little bit the brain to this cutoff, but still we keep the infrared to infinity. This is called the Randall-Sundrum 2 proposal. Just giving you the name. This proposal where you have Z epsilon to Z IR, where you have two boundaries, this is called the Randall-Sundrum 1 proposal. That's because it came first. So that's for gravity. Let's see what the CFT is saying. So what did we do? We took a CFT and we added a cutoff. You have to remember, two boundaries, RS1, one boundary, RS2. So from the gravity side, or the gauge side, sorry. The way you will interpret this correction is as taking the CFT plus adding a loop correction with gravitons. This will be the leading order correction. So the same here, this is just 1 over kr squared plus order 1 over kr. I'm not sure if it's 4 or 3. So we are just taking the leading order correction, the same in the CFT side. We say we are going to compute a correlator in the CFT and in a loop correction. And what they explain is that this correction is going to look as 1 over p squared tt 1 over p squared when this is the stress tensor correlator. And because I don't know exactly how much you did in CFT, I don't know if you did this kind of thing in the CFT course. Did you? Cool.
Why is computing the correlation with stress tensors? Why is that related to graviton?
Yeah. So, I don't know how simple it is to explain that.
It's just so in the gravity side, that's what couples to the metric.
Yes. Ah, okay. That's of course. Yes. Yeah, of course. The stress tensor is what couples to gravity. That's why we are computing this particular loop correction, and that's why we interpret this stress tensor correlator as a correction from gravity. Yeah. Sorry.
The field sourcing. One is the source of the other, basically.
But I guess this kind of things you will be happy with. Okay, so you do that, you obtain exactly the same kind of correction, type of correction, because you do, for example, t minus 2, 1 over p squared, 1 over p squared. This is the correction. It looks like 1 over r cube with some, I think it's c here, the central charge, or your CFT. So, what these people realize is that this correction is parametrically the same as in the ADS side, 1 over R cube. And on top of that, this correction will be the same if you interpret the central charge or your CFT as a function of your curvature in ADS. So by doing this check, by moving a little bit the ultraviolet brain away from zero, they were able to add dynamical gravity and to make a check. And this check gave them a relation between the central charge in one side and in the other side, the curvature of ADS. So modifying the picture of ADS of infinite ADS is important because then you start getting entries for your dictionary.
Five-dimensional gravity.
Yes. But the five-dimensional gravity is sourcing, as you say, the four-dimensional gravity of the field. Okay. So, and I'm not sure if you read anything else. So, as we just saw, adding an infinite range is actually breaking down the conformal invariance, and the way it shows up is by giving you an infinite number of Karusakarian resonances. And I think I will just stop by telling you one last thing. In the paper, you read why there is no strong coupling problem in ADS. And the idea is that, let's say I have my standard model particles here. And here my cutoff is precisely epsilon, which is 1 over n Planck. So my theory is a field theory that is valid all to n Planck. But if I start thinking on all the contributions that come from the bulk, it may seem that at some point I'm going to run into a strong coupling, even from the 5D point of view, because I will have a bunch of Karusakarian contributions to all my correlators. So they explain something there that I call non-locality. Locality. The idea is that whenever you want to fill the bulk from any position in an extra dimension, you need to pay a price. The price is the non-locality. So let's say that I am here, and I want to know about something happening here. Let's say I break through supersymmetry at a finite position in the extra dimension. Well, the way I'm going to know about supersymmetry breaking is because somebody is going to come and tell me. And this somebody coming and telling me about supersymmetry breaking has to propagate into the extra dimension. And whenever you propagate, the propagator looks like the four-dimensional momentum times the distance in the extra dimension you travel. So if my theory is breaking supersymmetry at a very high scale, by the time it arrives to me, it's telling me that supersymmetry is broken at a much smaller scale, suppressed by itself. So this non-locality, the fact that whenever you want to gain information or get contributions from the bulk, you have to pay this price, is very important. It's called non-locality. And that's what makes that you can build finite viable models of supersymmetry breaking or electroweak symmetry breaking in the bulk. That you know that all the ultraviolet contributions will be under work protected by non-locality. And I think I'm going to stop here. Unless you have any questions. Try to read a little bit more of the paper. I know that it's a lot of blah, 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 very little computation, but, you know, it's kind of... Yes,
is that basically saying that you have a mechanism to explain, like, what the whole business of
The caveat is, imagine that now the guy that is propagating in the extra dimension is massless. If it's massless, he doesn't care. He doesn't get this exponential suppression. So the only way I can propagate into the extra dimension, I can pass information about breakings and symmetries from one side to the other in the extra dimension, is, and no exponential suppression, is through massless modes. So this will be our basis for writing down a realistic electroweak symmetry breaking in extra dimensions. And we do that tomorrow. Let's start with that tomorrow. So this, if I want to send out a Karusakarian guy, a Karusakarian graviton, and tell me what's going on, or Karusakarian gate boson, whatever you want, if I am at a distance V with respect to the source of this breaking, I'm going to pay this price. The only way I don't pay any price is to get a flat mode, or a massless mode. we will see that in detail, don't worry. But get the idea that the one of the ways, the part of the magic of ADS is not even ADS, is the fact of having an extra dimension. And whenever you have an extra dimension, non-locality is helping you a lot. That's why we also have a bunch of models in flat extra dimension that work pretty well. They don't have an ADS CFT interpretation, but you have this kind of protection from non-locality. Yeah, so you will get an extra contribution, even more separation for the Wolf factor. But just in flat space, you will get that. Which is cool. All right. See you tomorrow.